This is a case where the film has underperformed in theaters, at least. It hasn't quite gotten the audience that they assumed it would. But for me, the point of departure is to partly consider that and maybe the reasons why. But also, for me at least, to think about the bigger picture, namely that it's so common nowadays to have franchises be rebooted after a period of years. This is an extreme example, though. Let's remind ourselves that the first Matrix came out in 1999, and we actually use it in one of our film history courses because it really does, in the late 20th century, give a sense of where science fiction, where these fantasy films will be headed in the 20-some years since then.
Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about movies that are out right now, starting with The Matrix Resurrections. Now, this movie had a lot of buzz. A lot of people were looking for this to come out with great anticipation. And I think that they did a smart thing by releasing it on HBO Max at the same time it went out in the theaters, because it made a lot of people not just watch it because they could watch it from home with HBO Max, but they could also watch all the other ones that came before it. So you could binge the whole thing right up to the moment the new one came out, and you know, then you were completely up to date. So I think that was a smart decision by HBO. However, Mike, I know you saw this in the theater. So tell me how it was in the theater, because I don't think everybody's that interested in what it was like from my living room.
I don't know. You probably had as large a crowd in your living room as I had in the theater. This is a case where the film has underperformed in theaters, at least. It hasn't quite gotten the audience that they assumed it would. But for me, the point of departure is to partly consider that and maybe the reasons why. But also, for me at least, to think about the bigger picture, namely that it's so common nowadays to have franchises be rebooted after a period of years. This is an extreme example, though. Let's remind ourselves that the first Matrix came out in 1999, and we actually use it in one of our film history courses because it really does, in the late 20th century, give a sense of where science fiction, where these fantasy films will be headed in the 20-some years since then. But think about how far back we're going. A movie that came out in 1999, and then, of course, two sequels that followed rather quickly in 2003, coming out in the same year, which is interesting, but then nothing since then. So it's like, you know, 18 years will transpire before we get this resurrection of it. And Marie, it's almost like a semantic or, let's say, philosophical consideration, what to even call it. Do we call it a reboot? Do we call it a sequel? Do we call it a remake? I mean, let's actually linger on that for a moment. I mean, how do you actually categorize a film like this, which in its own way overtly does recall the earlier pictures, because the character of Thomas Anderson is, you know, ironically, is a video game designer who's been working on the very movies we were just talking about in terms of the first installments of The Matrix. So it's very self-reflexive that way, too. But let me double back on that sort of impossible question of what do you even call a film like this? I'm, you know, push come to shove, just calling it a reboot. What are you calling it?
I'm calling it a reboot, too, I'm calling it a reboot because it really, in a lot of ways, is retelling the first movie again, with some of the same shots even, and most of the same characters. Now, of course, I'm glad all those people are back. I enjoyed watching it for the physicality of it, if only because, you know, that was, what, 30 years ago, right? Not quite, 20 plus years ago. It's really difficult to keep that level of fitness. So hats off to Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss for being able to, you know, recreate their characters believably, but you can tell that they're no longer, you know, people in their 30s, which I think, as long as you're just rolling with the story, it's fine. But when you really start to look at it, you can see that they're not going to be able to keep this going and keep making these movies with these people as these characters, as if they're ageless. Having said that, I think that the other thing I wanted to mention was the original movie was groundbreaking in the way that it showed bullet time, you know, where you actually got to see the bullet in super slow motion and everybody moving in super slow motion. That was super cool when it came out. Here, they're taking advantage of that as well. And the CGI and everything is so much more impressive, but it's not groundbreaking anymore. And I think that's the thing that's missing in this reboot, is you're expecting something that was, it's going to blow your mind the way the first movie did. By the way, I thought the two that came after it were really pretty forgettable. What did you think, Mike?
Marie, you make a good point. I was not a big fan of the original Matrix, but I acknowledge its importance in terms of taking science fantasy into the 21st century, in terms of, you know, the really great, for the time, CGI. But one thing we talk about in our film history course, where we use the Matrix from 1999, is the fact that bullet time was mind-blowing. It was fabulous. Then now it's so familiar, it's so overused, that to see it used again in this Matrix, like, okay, now it's time for some more bullet time. As you watch the bullet in slow motion, you could go out for popcorn or something, right? And come back and wait for it to hit the target. So that's something that hurts the film, really, is the overfamiliarity of not just this material, but the fact that so many movies since then have taken from the Matrix, learned from it, if you will. A second point you made that's really crucial is that it is interesting to see Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss, who are very plausible. They really work well together here. But by the same token, and let's get some grim numbers in here, Keanu Reeves is 57 now. Carrie Ann Moss is 54. They look great for that, so more power to them, and they work well in the film. But Marie, you make the very realistic, very pragmatic point. How many more sequels could you get from this? Because they're really, you know, well into middle age. You know, to what extent should they still have the existential crises and problems that you typically associate with a somewhat younger character? No reason why older people can't have the same worries, but typically with younger characters. And there's that to consider. And also just simply the fact that, you know, this film has already played out the formula. So Marie, back to one of your other reservations about it, a third or fourth reservation here is, the original Matrix scored critically and commercially and creatively had all that influence. That's why we use it in the course, actually, how it influenced science fiction. But you know what? The sequels that came out in 2003 in quick succession were totally forgettable. They really sort of went down what I call the rabbit hole. They just like, well, do this, do that. And it just, you know, and it reminded me of the co-directors of the film, the siblings Wachowski. When you think about it, it helps when they have a shorter leash. For the first Matrix, they had producers who kept them on a relatively short leash so that, you know, there was some degree of plausibility, some degree of logic, whatever. And so, you know, rein them in a bit. In the later sequels, and then where it really, I think, becomes disastrous is, did you have the misfortune of seeing Jupiter Ascending in 2015? It's just totally meaningless, worthless, you know, scratch your head. What was that all about? And I think there's that quality in their work where once they go down the rabbit hole, watch out sometimes, because it's just one bizarre thing after another. And ultimately, for me as a viewer, it's not just that I can't always follow it. And, you know, I feel like the village idiot, like, what was that all about? But secondly, I don't care to follow it. It just seems like arbitrary at a certain point. And this film, this current one, we'll call it a reboot, is so busy with all that, dredging up the old characters, this and that, flashbacks, all sorts of stuff thrown in. It's like almost like throwing too many ingredients into the pot and stirring it some more. And I get to the point where I just think enough already. And again, it has a running time of 148 minutes. So again, the usual problem with a film like this, it doesn't know when to quit. It just keeps piling on more. So let me pile on more by asking you about that. Do you want to pile on with some more observations about this?
I'll pile on. By the way, I've not seen Jupiter Ascending, so I'll put that on my list of don't bother. What I think you've hit on is the rabbit hole that you're describing is what I call the RoboCop effect, where you make this movie that is just amazing and everybody watches it and talks about it, remarks upon it. And then they just decide to use the idea and make subsequent movies, sequels that are just flat out terrible. However, there's two RoboCop, you know, sequels. I do think you probably could get somebody to write a really good script and make a brand new RoboCop. I think that idea is still valid. I don't think they should make any more Matrix movies though. What is out there that I think we need to acknowledge is this Matrix lore. I mean, there are people out there who absolutely love the Matrix, who watched all three movies, were waiting with bated breath to see the new one come out. Lots of people had watch parties where they had, you know, their entire family come over and watch all three of the, you know, first three. And then, you know, ending with what was supposed to be the mind-blowing fourth one. And a lot of people enjoyed themselves. When I say lore, I mean things like not just the bullet time, but the idea of taking the red pill as opposed to the blue pill. That's actually so well just out there in terms of political commentary that people might not even realize that idea first came from the Matrix. There's also sort of spin-off things like Ghost in the Shell, which had a lot to do with the way The Matrix looks. And lots of people who like anime have seen Ghost in the Shell and have seen the Scarlett Johansson live action remake of that movie. So, you know, it's got a fan base in there that's, it's not just like sci-fi people or Keanu Reeves fans, but I think those things are part of the reason that this should have done better. And it probably didn't do as well in the theaters because I think a lot of people were home watching it on their couch.
Well, Marie, you're absolutely right about this as a pop cultural phenomenon, and it goes beyond the fan base, but it's essentially made for the fan base, but it's entered pop culture in a way where people use the red pill, blue pill kind of language. Maybe not even, you're absolutely right about that, not even realizing where the expression comes from, if you will. So let me, for the moment, pitch it from the director's perspective. You know, again, Lana and Lily Wachowski had directed the earlier ones. Lana directs this one on her own, okay? So it's going solo on this one. But in terms of what she's trying to do with this reboot of it, there was an interview where she gave an interesting quote, because as I watched it, I kept thinking, and you have to think about Alice in Wonderland. You keep thinking about alternate worlds or alternative realms, if you will. And here's a quote from her directly to that effect. She says this about the current film in particular. Art is a mirror. Most will prefer to gaze at the surface, but there will be people like me who enjoy what lies behind the looking glass. I made this movie for them. So again, I think in a very pithy way, she knows her audience, she knows the fan base, but I've got to confess, and I'm happy to confess, I'm not really part of that fan base. So even though I could admire the original film for the technical virtuosity, which was state of the art for 1999, by now bullet time is old time, you know what I mean? It's just overly familiar. And to have all these characters come back, they're able to pull it off, but by the same token, I'm not looking for more installments. I mean, personally, I think they've kind of milked the material about as much as it can be. But again, once you go down the rabbit hole, once you go through the mirror, use whatever metaphoric images you want here, once you've done that, it's almost like anything goes, right? You can just like bend the laws of physics and everything else. And the more you do that, for me, I just feel like, well, anything goes, and I just find myself caring less. You know what I'm getting at? It just seems like, oh, well, that happened. Now this happens. Now they jump here and they jump there, and guess who pops up from the past? And, you know, I think we all probably need some sort of pill at that point.
Good point, Mike. I will say I was sort of disappointed they didn't try to do something new and different with the costuming, because when Keanu Reeves comes out and he's wearing that black trench coat, you know, I did stop and think, oh, right, Columbine, that's where they got that idea. I found it a little bit off-putting. Having said that, though, I will say one of the reasons I think the movie succeeds is Keanu Reeves. I think lots of people like him doing that kind of role, because I was also looking at him thinking, it's John Wick. You know, John Wick is also always dressed in all black, and of course he's, you know, a badass with a gun and any other weapon he can get his hands on. So I don't think anybody needs any more Matrix movies to get more of that, as long as they keep making John Wick movies. What do you think about that comparison, Mike, in terms of Keanu Reeves?
I think it's a really valid comparison. And I think actually for him as an actor, it can be a bit of a salvation, if you will. By salvation, I mean this. Because this reboot of Matrix hasn't done quite as well as they assumed it would, it doesn't mean that people are tired of him, because, you know, with John Wick and other roles, he knows how to play that kind of character, and he's really convincing. And it's easy to make jokes about him. And speaking of pop culture, people have joked about him for many years, like, you know, is he human kind of jokes? What is he? And so put all that aside, I mean, he's capable of playing roles like this very well. And for an actor well into his 50s, he could, you know, even if he doesn't do another Matrix, John Wick, or just similar roles, you know, an actor like that can age gracefully. You know what I mean? The kind of character he plays, he can go on playing. So I don't worry about him that way. I just frankly, on a personal level, don't want to see any more Matrix movies. I've sort of sequeled out where that's concerned. Maybe, oh, let's put it this way. I'll wait another 18 years and then Lana Wachowski can hit the go button again, or take the pill that facilitates all this. What do you think about this in terms of, you know, a franchise like this? I honestly, and this sounds kind of cynical on my part, but I almost wish they just let it rest. I mean, it was a significant film at its time, forgettable sequels, just let it go. Let those pop cultural memories be there. I honestly was not personally looking for a reboot here.
I wasn't either. I do think there's maybe one opportunity for a parody movie where John Wick or Keanu Reeves' character from Bill and Ted end up in the Matrix. You know, John Wick drops into the Matrix. They could do something funny with that. But other than that, I hope that they just sort of retire the idea, because what's been done in terms of special effects, I think, are impressive, but I don't think you need the Matrix framework to get those kinds of special effects out there, if that's what you want to play with.
Murray, when you mentioned Bill and Ted, it started me thinking there is a kind of self-reflexive quality that I alluded to earlier in our episode, namely that, you know, his character, Thomas Anderson, is this video game designer who is designing, you know, a Matrix game. And so he can't quite remember his past at that point, right? But somehow this is the game he's working on. And the film does have some fun with that it's actually referencing the earlier Matrix movies. But, you know, for me, that's the kind of self-reflexive fun where it makes me smile for 5 minutes. But in a film that's really long, that I can't hold that smile. You know what I'm getting at? Like, there's only a certain amount of self-reflexivity that a movie can hold on to. But it's almost inevitable in a franchise like this, you're going to allude to earlier films. You might as well, by way of pop culture, just acknowledge that you're watching a movie that knows it's a movie that's referring to its earlier installments. I mean, did you also see that quality to it, that it's very much a sort of meta movie, if you will? It's a film that's aware of its status as a film. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think it is very meta, and I think it loves being associated with the word meta, because the pretentiousness of the word meta is actually very appropriate here, because it is something sort of over the top. It's like, it's almost too much. Like, we get it about the alternate universe. So any special effects do you think it has a chance outside of special effects for any Oscars, Mike?
Murray, this film is a good example of one that will get nominations in technical categories, but I don't see it really accruing awards recognition much beyond that. I really don't. I mean, technically it is well made, but so what? I mean, almost all these films are technically well crafted, but in terms of, you know, acting or directing, whatever, I really don't see anything particularly notable about it in that respect. If anything, it's kind of confusing. It does seem sort of tossed together in a lot of ways. And I know it's sort of deliberate, like, let's do this, let's do that. But, you know, usually in terms of giving awards out, you want a bit more, when I say consistency, a kind of constancy, a sense of an overall look or tone or thematic cohesiveness. But this film bounces all over the place in a way that sort of gave me a headache after a while. And again, I was only half joking about, what's the pill for headache? You know, what should we do here? But I think things like that mitigate against oftentimes awards recognition, because it just seems like the film is, you know, it's full of itself and it's playing to a fan base, and that's fine on its own terms there. But I don't see why people outside of that, you know, would necessarily want to, you know, shower, you know, awards and other honors on it. I mean, what do you think there? I don't think the film really merits that kind of recognition.
No, unfortunately, it does not. But I do think it will be nominated for some technical categories, because it is really cool to look at. What they're able to do with movies today is really amazing. So it's worth watching just for that, and to know what everybody else is talking about. So moving on to our other movies that we're going to talk about on this show. Mike, I know you've seen some stuff in the theaters. Tell us what's out there that we should go see.
Well, you know, because December and into early January is when so many of the big award-according movies are coming out. I mean, that really is the year end where you get the prestige pictures coming out. And, you know, whether they all work aesthetically or not, these are like top of the line pictures. And so the one I would single out is, I think, really a striking film in a lot of ways, is The Tragedy of Macbeth. We all know the Coen brothers. This is a case where Joel Coen is writing. Well, he's right. When I say writing here, his co-writer is William Shakespeare. So this is where Joel Coen is writing and on his own directing. So it's really the first time he's gone without, you know, working directly with his brother, Ethan. But Joel is working with his real life wife, of course, Frances McDormand. And so this is their take, their version of Macbeth. One thing that plays to advantage here is, well, the fact that it's the Coen brother, not brothers. They know how to make a movie, you know, and he works consistently well with the same team oftentimes, including like the composer, Carter Burwell, and so on. So he knows how to assemble that kind of talent with him. But one of the things that plays to advantage in terms of the material, yes, it's Shakespeare, but the thing about Macbeth is it's the shortest of Shakespeare's tragedies, and it really moves fast. It's an action picture, if you will. And Joel Coen, he plays that to advantage. It's a really lean, kind of muscular take on what's already a lean and muscular play. The fact that it's shot in black and white, it's so austere, it's so expressionistic. And indeed, if you're familiar with Orson Welles' treatment of Shakespeare in a few films, it looks like an Orson Welles film. It could be Chimes at Midnight or, you know, Othello, Macbeth, all the various projects that Welles worked on over the decades that were Shakespeare related. It has that visual palette, that look to it. That all plays to advantage. It's so atmospheric. It's so austerely effective on those levels. Now, in terms of the acting, yes, it works on that level too. Denzel Washington, of course, plays Macbeth. Obviously, you know, a great actor, so all due credit there. I got to say, though, that just as Macbeth kind of charges ahead, this straight ahead, take charge personality, Washington does that to an extreme. There are places where I'll feel like I'm an acting teacher, you know, taking a student to task, and goodness knows I shouldn't do that with Denzel Washington. But there are places where he rushes his lines. He just charges through the lines, and you lose some of the poetry of Shakespeare when the lines are barked and shouted and the words run together. They really do. And I know a lot of people have admired his performance, and it is strong. But scene by scene, there were places where I thought, well, man, you know, slow down a little bit. Put like a half second between this word and that word, if you will. So I was sort of, you know, picking at it that way. But he, you know, push come to shove, it's a strong performance. As Lady Macbeth, what can I say? Frances McDormand knows how to be Lady Macbeth. She plays that quite convincingly. So there are other aspects of the film we could talk about, but I think it's a really interesting film. It's a really interesting take on Macbeth. And again, visually and dramatically, it really holds your attention. Other films that I can talk about in a bit, but I want to turn it over to you, would be Licorice Pizza and Nightmare Alley. But let me turn it back over to you to get some of your takes on films you've been watching recently.
Okay, well, I just want to ask you if you felt the lack of Ethan in it in terms of, you know, Coen Brothers movies, real quick.
Really, no, because even though, like, originally in their careers, they were sort of parceled out, like, okay, well, you know, he's the director, and then they co-write and this and that. They later confessed, and we already knew it, they did everything together, right? They just shared in all of it. And, you know, it's a sensibility. And so the short answer to your question is, I didn't feel like asking, like, where's Ethan? No, not at all. I mean, it just seemed to me it was a Coen Brother film. So singular rather than plural, but the same kind of, when I say sensibility, I mean, like, creatively, they know how to put a film together. It all works. It all coheres. You know what I mean? There's a look to it. There's a sound to it. There's nothing jarring. It's really cohesive that way. So no, on his own, he's fine. He you know, he can work with his brother, but he works on his own just fine, thanks. So that's not a problem at all. And of course, you know, by way of a co-writer, hey, you know, you got all that great Shakespeare dialogue, which comes intact here. It's more a matter of editing, right? It's not so much rewriting. It's more a matter of editing it. And he's really judicious. He's really careful about how he takes the short play and really gets it down to its essence. So he does a really great job with that.
Well, I'm going to talk about Don't Look Up, which is a Netflix production. It's actually gotten quite a lot of buzz. It's very controversial. People have very strong opinions about it. It is already nominated for 3 Golden Globes, one for Best Screenplay, one for Best Actor, and Best Actress. Now, the Best Actor, Best Actress are Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, who play astronomers who are trying to warn the world that a giant comet is headed our way and is going to obliterate Earth. That's the setup. Now, what's effective about this movie is just the sheer star power. Every time you turn around, there's like another famous person you didn't expect to see coming. Meryl Streep plays the American president. So that part of it is enjoyable and jarring, because I think the movie actually would have been better off with some nobodies playing these characters, because it's parody. Speaking of RoboCop, it has these funny moments of sly digs at things. In some ways, it is sort of a hatchet piece on the far right, but it does it in sort of a overbearing way. Speaking of red pills and blue pills, you know, that comes up in the movie, of course. And by the way, Mike, the green pill is Advil. While you were talking about that, I was thinking about the fact that you said, what's the one for the headache? And I thought, you know, I wonder if there was an actual decision by Advil to make it green and not red or blue, because, you know, that could have been, you know, something that gave people pause. I think that there was a lot of good ideas in Don't Look Up, some of which almost make it. It's too long. It's too ponderous. I've heard people comparing the comet to, oh, it's really supposed to be an allegory about climate change. And then other people say, no, it's really an allegory about COVID. What makes it disappointing, and I think it just, they made it too soon. We're already in climate change anxiety. We're already in the worries about COVID. And it just is not entertaining to watch movies about it yet. This might have been a really great movie 10 years from now, maybe even 5 years from now, when you could look back with a little bit of cynicism. It's just too raw. I think that the parts that are supposed to get you thinking like, wow, we should get serious about these serious problems, don't quite work. And it's ultimately defeating because there's so much selfishness and greed at the levels where people make decisions. And like I said, it's good for the story, but it just is very disappointing from a standpoint of entertainment. Having said that, you got to see it because everybody's talking about it. And because it is up for 3 Golden Globes, you at least want to know what the fuss is all about. So watch it for those reasons, but you'll want to like it more than you will actually like it. So Mike, we have about 4 minutes left. If you want to give us a quick, you know, review of Licorice Pizza and or Nightmare Alley.
Well, very quickly for both films, I had mixed to negative responses there. I went in with high expectations and then felt kind of disappointed. Licorice Pizza is the latest film from Paul Thomas Anderson. And, you know, certainly an accomplished director. And it's set in 1973. It works at the level of immersing you in the pop culture of the early 70s. He's expert at that. Think about Boogie Nights from 1997. He knows how to take you back to essentially his upbringing, right? And everything's in place there in terms of the fashions, the music you hear on the soundtrack, all that's locked in place. In terms of the relationship at the heart of the story, it's a 15-year-old high school student who falls in love with, if that's the way to put it, a woman who's 25, who's like an assistant to a photographer at the school taking yearbook photos. And so it's very much character-based that way. The film itself is 133 minutes long, not too long, but it meanders. It's just too long, and it just sort of soaks in the atmosphere, the environment, and I don't think really develops the characters as much as it could, and I think sort of squanders opportunities that way. But, you know, it does hold your interest just as a period piece, but just sort of kind of like wallows in that. And it's that meandering quality. It's very uneven. Some scenes work really well. Others are like, oh, I wish they had taken the scissors to that and just cut that out. So very mixed response to it. The other one quickly is Nightmare Alley, which is the latest film from Guillermo del Toro. And, you know, I've loved some of his earlier works, particularly Pan's Labyrinth, which I use in a Spanish film history course. This film, though, has some of the same problems. It's set in the 1930s, and it immerses you in what I'll call carnival culture, sideshow culture. Think about Todd Browning's Freaks from 1932, all that. It does a great job of placing you in that environment, and then it gives you the story, if you will. And the story is marginally interesting, but it's very superficially developed. There's really very little character development. Indeed, even though Cate Blanchett pops up as a femme fatale, she plays it as if she has quotation marks around the performance. It's at that level of, you know, great looking production design, but not much to the character. And I think in general, including the main character played very well by Bradley Cooper, this is a problem. Del Toro sets up the scene, sets up the environment, lets the characters loose. Yes, there's a story, but he's not very good with the character development. All that's kind of flat. And the whole film just sort of wears out its welcome after a while. You spend too much time at the carnival, if you will, before it even really gets going. So very mixed response to those two films. How about you in terms of things you've been watching?
Well, I have watched other things that I think we'll save for another episode. But in terms of Licorice Pizza, I did want to mention that it is up in terms of the Golden Globes for Best Picture, Screenplay, Actor, and Actress. So that probably has more buzz than Nightmare Alley in terms of deciding what to go see. But that does bring us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.